Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our Reviews Editor, Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
This week, we're going to go for a spin with Russell Crowe's Unhinged. We're going to be keeping a stiff upper lip with Gemma Arterton's wartime drama, Summerland. We'll be spacing out with Eva Green's astronaut film, Proxima. And we're going caravanning with British indie Makeup. But before we do all that, we should probably take a moment, shouldn't we, to appreciate a true Hollywood star who passed away this week at the age of 104. Let's hear it for Olivia de Havilland.
God, I'm so glad to see you. You have so much life. I've always admired you so. I wish I could be more like you. Oh, you're wrong, India. Gaul is just high-spirited and vivacious.
So Olivia de Havilland, probably the last star of the Golden Age, would we say?
She's the last surviving major cast member of Gone with the Wind. She was best friends with Bette Davis. She was a longtime sort of co-star of Errol Flynn. She had a big spat with her sister, Joan Fontaine. She was part of that massive sort of iconography of the Golden Age of Hollywood. So she is the last of a special kind of star, I suppose.
What do you think is her best role? Or maybe outside of Gone with the Wind, what were her other notable roles?
I think that's probably her best known, isn't it? You know, and something she was very proud of, like when that was being cast, everybody wanted to play Scarlett O'Hara, but she wanted to play Melanie, this sort of sweet, kind, dignified woman in this piece, because she thought that was more of a challenge to play a good girl than it was to play a bad girl. You know, she did really well. She got nominated for that. But, you know, she's done a lot of more interesting work, I'd say, like The Heiress, which she got an Oscar for.
Oh, yeah, that's great. Yeah,
she's really good in that. And I also love her in My Cousin Rachel. Obviously, her sister was in Rebecca, but she was in My Cousin Rachel playing the titular Rachel. And she's really good in that. She legendarily replaced Joan Crawford on Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. And did really nice job with that. She's got a massive back catalogue. She worked for five decades. I mean, amazing.
Good honor.
And, you know, I think she's just really interesting as well, because she's not just this simpering starlet. She actually was more Scarlett O'Hara than she was Melanie in real life, in as much as she took Warner Brothers to court and successfully sued them for extending her contract after she didn't want to play certain roles. When her contract came to an end, they tried to extend it, and she took them to court, sued them, and now there is de Havilland's law, which is still upheld today. I mean, even Jared Leto has said he used de Havilland's law to get out of a contract with his band.
Trailblazer.
She was pretty kick-ass, and she was a dame, and, you know, she was recognised by France and lived in France in the last few years of her life. So, a really interesting woman. So, not just Melanie from Gone with the Wind, I reckon. Have you seen any of her stuff, Matt? Or is this all new to you?
It's mostly new to me, to be honest. There's a lot I need to dig into there, and a lot of good recommendations.
Okay, well, RIP Olivia de Havilland. I'm sure we'll be seeing her in a lot of the obit sections of award shows, if we ever get to award shows. Okay, so the cinemas are opening, though, so it looks like we might be getting a little bit closer towards awards shows. And we've actually got some movies that are out in actual cinemas this week.
Good grief.
I know. Unbelievable.
I know. So shall we look at a Hollywood heavyweight with Russell Crowe? He's driving angry with this one.
You know what a courtesy tap is, young man?
Sounds like this. It's light. It's friendly.
Sure, that's what your mom meant to do.
No, it's not.
Mom!
Having a kind of a hard time lately.
I'm sorry.
Accept my apology?
Just ignore him.
If you could just do the same, we could press reset.
I don't have anything to apologize for. Can you go, please?
Okay, so that's Unhinged, which is out this Friday. Matt Matem, who's unhinged? How is Russell Crowe unhinged?
Well, Russell Crowe is unhinged in this film. So basically, as the film starts, we see Russell Crowe very angry in his car, early hours of the morning, fiendish plan brewing, where he's clearly got some kind of retribution he wants to take. He's clearly not a well man. Yeah, we see this kind of act of retribution very early on, before we jump to the character of Rachel, played by Karen Pistorius, and we kind of get a bit of a sense of her life. She's sharing a house with her brother. Her mum's not very well. She's in a care home. And her life is kind of falling apart a little bit. Like, there's a book about how to keep your child happy during divorce on the table.
On the side table, yeah.
Clearly things are a bit stressful. She's a hairstylist and she's just about to lose a big client. And she sets off for a day in the car, but gets into a sort of beeping match with Russell Crowe's character when he's sort of sitting at a green light in front of her. And it all escalates from there, where he's not happy to be beeped at. He asks for an apology. She doesn't give him one. And then, you know, he feels like she needs to be sort of punished for that. And he's about to make her day hell.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is basically Falling Down and Duel, and very much from those sort of era of films, isn't it? I mean, it feels like a 90s thriller.
It really does feel like a 90s throwback, yeah.
But I'm not saying that in a bad way, because I don't know about you guys, but I really quite enjoyed it, because that's all I expected from it. And that's exactly what I got. And I felt like anybody could have written this film. Nothing completely surprising happens in it. However, they've just committed to it, haven't they? Like, Russell Crowe, he's understood the tone. He's understood what he's been hired to do, which is just Maximus Decimus Meridius gone absolutely mental. And he's gone for it. He's just full on going for it. And that's kind of enjoyable to watch.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, I mean, you know, from the opening seconds, how this is going to play out. Like, there's no doubt of the plot twists. I call them twists. They're not really twists. You know, it's just a very, very straightforward cat and mouse movie. It knows its limitations. It's under 90 minutes, which is a very sensible length for a film of this kind. It never kind of dips momentum once the setup's in place. It's just kind of chase, confrontation, the end. Karen Pistorius makes a very sympathetic heroine, I thought, and he makes a very despicable villain. I mean, he's got no redeeming features whatsoever, and he, like you say, he just really, really goes for it. He's utterly malicious and cruel and evil and taking this way beyond, you know, asking for an apology. He just goes way overboard. Yeah, it's kind of enjoyable.
Did you like it, Matt?
I think I liked it slightly less than you guys, perhaps. I thought it was enjoyable in like an extremely trashy way, in a kind of 90s throwback.
Yeah.
But there were some aspects of it that I felt were a bit too dated. And it's one of those films is everything's extremely signposted. It's one of those, like, nothing's mentioned that doesn't end up
it's
coming
like,
back again.
This kitchen utensil is mentioned in passing in the kitchen. I wonder if that will come into play later.
Yeah. And there's another cultural reference, which will date the film in years to come, which nodded too early on and then comes up later, which is very obvious.
Yeah, and ultimately, deep down, I thought it was perhaps just a bit too silly, but there were some nice kind of car crashes that looked like they were real stunts and that were quite impressive. I actually thought, you know, for its brief running time, it was to generate tension. Like, I did feel quite like, you know, sort of gripped in the moment, even if like my kind of brain was telling me it was quite silly, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, if you've ever been in a room with Russell Crowe, you would apologise immediately to him. So like the menace that he throws off, he really is, you know, he's an imposing figure in this. Like, you don't doubt for a minute that this character is going to do all of the terrible things he says and the sort of pleasure he takes from doing it, you know, and the fact that they don't pull any punches with the fact that he does kill people. He's not messing here. He's in for the murder. He's having a murdery day. But at the same time, you cannot approach this with any kind of logic, because it just falls apart at the seams, doesn't it? So it's like, why are the police so terrible? I mean, just cannot get a man riding around all day in the same truck with, you know, with that 7-Eleven TXP number plate that people talk about. How is that not being picked up? How
he literally gets away with murder.
Literally does. So on that level, there's no point approaching this as any kind of logical thriller. But, you know, if you want a bit of Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Pacific Heights, it does what it says on the tin.
He moves around so fast as well. I mean, he seems to teleport from one bit of the film to another. Some of the things he gets up to, like when he kind of gets into a car, he does something that, I mean, it would take me about an hour, but he seems to do it in seconds.
Yeah.
And then he's just everywhere at once. He's like Michael Myers.
His accent shifts around quite a bit as well. At the very beginning, he's quite a southern gentleman. And then that seems to be forgotten halfway through. I mean, it's another one of those films that's shot in Louisiana, but pretending to be New York. That's sort of a disconnect as well. It clearly doesn't look like New York. And also, like, there's this casting aspect as well, that this girl She's 30 years old as Karen Pistorius, and she's playing this mother of a 15-year-old, and it's just like, it just doesn't stack up, you know. Admittedly, she could have had him at 15, but it's that classic trope, isn't it, of like this hot young mum has to be young and hot, being terrorised by this awful old man, this beast of a bloke in a car, and there's nothing she can do to stop him. But maybe there is. And the fact as well that at certain points, terrible things happen to certain characters and they come away with a slight graze on their cheek and nobody wants to take them to the hospital or give them any sort of therapy.
No time for that.
Just go on your way. Go on your way. It's ridiculous.
There was some quite harsh collateral damage in the film as well.
The dying scene is particularly nasty.
But they sort of try to, don't they? I mean, it has this pre-title sequence that is all sort of real footage, sort of YouTube footage of people losing it in the real world, which is astonishing to watch some of that footage in itself. There's a bit with a guy on a motorcycle who has a crossword with someone on the freeway. I don't know if you remember this little clip, and kicks the car and then it all spirals out of control. That's real footage. That in itself is probably more interesting than the sort of actual events that happen in this film. So there's this idea that they're trying to ground it in this relevance and the fact that it's about how none of us have any sort of sympathy for other people's bad days or understanding that other people can be having problems and that's informing the way that they behave. But really, do you want it to be relevant when it's a film like this? Don't you just forget that stuff? It's just a psycho. Yeah, and that's what she calls him. He's a psycho. And he's just a classic cinema psycho, and that's all there is to it. I don't think they need to try to ground it.
It was supposed to come out a couple of weeks ago, wasn't it? But it's obviously been pushed back slightly.
Yeah,
as it is one of the first big films coming back to cinemas with a big star, it's very, very easy to watch. So if you want to brace yourself back into cinema kind of gently, it's not at all demanding. So if you just want a kind of popcorn movie.
And those action sequences will, you know, pop on a big screen and the sound will be good. And at 90 minutes, that's not too long to expose yourself to other people's mouth germs. So I think we'd probably say go for it. If you're fancying a trip to the cinema, would we suggest people have a go on this one?
Yeah, because you know what you're getting with it. No bones about it. So go for it.
Okay, so that is Unhinged, which is out at cinemas today, Friday the 31st. Okay, so shall we go from sort of crash bang wallop of Russell Crowe to something a little more cozy with this?
We were expecting you an hour ago.
Sorry?
Frank? This is Miss Lamb, your new guardian.
I don't want him. We've all got to do our bit.
I'm supposed to go to school.
Go on then.
Where is it?
This is Frank. He's an evacuee from London. Miss Lamb, I know you're busy writing your stories.
Academic theses.
Did they look very interesting?
I wrote them.
So that is Summerland. Matthew, what's this
about? Hello. It's set during World War II. It's the feature directorial and writing debut of Jessica Swale, and it centres on Gemma Arterton's Alice Lamb, who is a kind of reclusive writer, and she reluctantly takes in an evacuee from London, this young lad called Frank. And she's obviously initially hostile to him, but spoiler alert, things perhaps start to thaw out between them and a friendship develops. There's more to it than that, but perhaps I shouldn't get into any of the latter twists. But yeah, this is essentially a kind of a friendship bonding movie.
Well, I mean, there is a certain element to it that perhaps should be mentioned because it makes it a bit of a more unusual World War II drama in as much as there is a gay romance that is between Gemma Arterton and Gugu Mbatha-Raw's character.
Yeah.
This is her lost love, and this is partly why she's so reclusive and angry at the world, because this is a love that cannot speak its name, and she is sort of ostracized by the town that she lives in as a witch, as a sort of mad old batty spinster. So it has
quids in a postbox, isn't it?
Yeah, I didn't really understand that as a method of harassment, but there we go.
But it's annoying, isn't it?
Yeah, the 40s, that's what you did.
More innocent time.
Yeah, but it does feel like there's a bit more interesting sort of characterization going on in terms of female characters in this. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, no, I thought the same. It was interesting that you got those flashbacks kind of layered in. You get this very, very brief frame at the beginning where Penelope Wilton is playing the older version of Alice. She's kind of writing up her story, and then you immediately jump back to Gemma Arterton in the 40s by the seaside during the war. And for me, it very much did have a sort of Sunday tea time vibe. Mm-hmm. Really, really felt like that. But I actually, within that, I did enjoy it quite a lot, actually. I found it very easy to watch. I thought Gemma Arston was very good in it. Yeah. It was easy to warm to her relationship with Frank, played by Lucas Bond. I found it just a nice film. I just enjoyed spending time with it. Whilst it's very, very predictable, as Matthew kind of said, in some senses, it didn't quite go as I was expecting in another way. So that kind of made me think a bit like, oh, it wasn't quite as predictable as it first
seemed. Yeah. I did feel that it was very much a contrivance towards the end that kind of that does bring it all together. But I found that a little bit hard to swallow initially. But then it did kind of win me over after that. I kind of warmed to it.
It is something that logically, probably, you'd be like, come on. But put within this context where it is, you know, her Alice's work is about folklore and fairy tales and how we use them as society to sort of make sense of the world and make sense of our emotions, particularly grieving. It kind of made sense in that aspect that it was a solution that was very neat and probably not very realistic, but that it sort of fed into that idea of happy endings and folklore and fairy stories and the stories we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better. So I kind of accepted it and bought it. And I like this idea. I mean, Summerland is this pagan idea of what heaven was. So there's a lot of discussion. Obviously, this is set in the war about where people may go when they die and what we believe in. That sounds a bit more heavy than it is. It's very light and fluffy. It's got a lot to do with clouds and distinguishing the shape of clouds. But I did think, you know, we're living in a difficult age at the moment with death all around us, that some people may take comfort from this, that it is something that's sort of cozy and warm and soothing and might be what you need with a nice cup of tea. Whether or not you're going to see in the cinema or not is another thing. What do you reckon?
Yeah, it's very much suited to small screen viewing, I think, really. It's kind of a Sunday evening cozy drama premiere. Yeah, perhaps you might have heightened expectations if you see it on the big screen, whereas maybe if you waited for Home End, I think you might perhaps get more out of it. I did enjoy it, certainly. It was lovely to see Tom Courtney as well. I thought he was terrific. the kind of bumbling but kindly headmaster.
But he's playing a similar role as he played in the Guernsey Pie and Eel and Potato, whatever, Literary Society. Who can ever get that title right? So, and it does feel, you know, very similar to that film in that sort of warm, cozy, sweet, and all ends wrapped up nicely. So if that's your thing and you enjoyed the eel pie, potato, literary, whatever the heck it's called, then this is one for you probably. Okay, so that is out again today, Friday. Two films at the cinema. Can't wait. Oh, what else have we got out at the cinema? What about this one? Shall we prepare for ignition with this?
I think you ought to ask him to lighten your load.
What do you know about my core skills?
T'es là? Ça va pas, non? Tu m'as fait peur!
Pars!
There's no such thing as a perfect astronaut. It's like there's no such thing as a perfect mother.
So that's Proxima, which is Eva Green as an astronaut. Matt, where do we find Eva? Is she in space? Is she on the ground? What's going on with this one?
Well, yeah, this is a space drama. It feels very realistic. It's not a kind of sort of sci-fi fantasy or anything like that. It's very much about the preparations for going up into space. And in that sense, it is mostly grounded. So when we find Eva Green's character, Sarah, at the beginning of the film, she's basically just found out that she's going to be fulfilling a lifelong ambition of going into space to work aboard the International Space Station for a year. So she's obviously very excited about that. But it comes with the sort of downside that she's got a young daughter and she's going to have to leave her behind for a year. So it follows her as she prepares for the really rigorous physical training required for going up into space, as well as kind of she's trying to become mentally prepared to sort of saying goodbye to her daughter for a year. And it's all about the kind of push and pull of that. It goes quite detailed really with the preparations, which I actually really enjoyed that side of it. You see a lot of these kind of weird machines and gadgets and various different training runs she goes on. But at the same time, then it is always grounded in this sort of emotion of the mother-daughter relationship. So I actually really liked it a lot. What did you guys think?
I loved it. This is going to be my film of this week, and it's probably going to make my top 10 of the year, because I just think it's so clever at giving you the minutiae of training to be an astronaut in Star City, and they actually, I believe, filmed in Star City in Russia, and what that includes, like the weird things like running up a wall that she does, and she has to run lying down, and the going in the G-force simulator, so all of us, her skin goes really funny. It's fascinating to watch, but at the same time, it's heart-wrenching to try to think what it would be like. You know, we've all experienced being apart from our loved ones for 3 or 4 months. Can you imagine being separated from them by a year and by, you know, so many miles? You're up in the International Space Station, and part of this particular mission is to shut themselves off from Earth. So shut all the windows to Earth to prepare for the astronauts that will come after them on a mission to Mars, who will be going further than that. It's emotionally, mentally, really challenging to watch. And I thought it was wonderful and beautifully filmed. What did you think, Matthew?
Yeah, I'd like to say a lot. I mean, it's great to see Eva Green. I mean, the last time I saw Eva Green, she was riding around on the back of a CGI elephant in Dumbo.
Oh, yes. So, let us forget.
Yeah. Which she did with dignity, to be fair, and grace. But yeah, it's great to see her, you know, absolutely front and centre. This film, I mean, it really kind of plays to her sort of understated intensity that she has. And you're just with her all the way. I mean, I'd need to watch it again, but I think every single shot is either from her perspective or the daughter's perspective. So you're really kind of locked in to these two characters. They have such a believable bond as well as mother and daughter. I mean, there's obviously, you know, there's friction, but there's obviously a lot of love between them as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think for me, the performances really carried it. The performances and the detail it goes into.
And it's also, you know, it's as much about women in the workplace as anything else as well. I mean, Matt Dillon, he's a misogynist astronaut, isn't he? He basically, when, you know, when he's told that she's joining the mission, he does a speech at a party that says he's really glad a French woman will be in space with him because he hears they cook well. Eva Green, if you love her as Vespa Lynn, you know, skewering Bond on that train, you're going to love her in this, because she is so calm and so cool, and she doesn't ever respond in a hysterical, quote marks, way to his provocations. She's just like, what do you know about my core skill set? You know, you don't know about me. I can do it. He tells her to lighten her load of her training because she might not be able to take it. And she's like, nah. She is so kick-ass. I just loved watching her master this. And she wanted to do it to prove him wrong. But key to it really is that she wants to prove that she can do it for herself. And that's really lovely to watch as well. I thought it was a great sort of performance from her. Do you think it might net her awards, Buzz?
I think there's every possibility, because it does feel like, you know, she's worked consistently over the last few years, but she hasn't had that role that can really show off what she can do. So yeah, I think she's overdue a bit of recognition, and I think this has kind of got the kind of prestige and class to it that I think could carry it over. And people love astronaut movies, don't they? I mean, astronaut movies just do so well at the moment. They're just like critics' darlings. I mean, after things like Ad Astra and Gravity and Interstellar and First Man, this could be really great for her.
Yeah. And I think the film itself probably will get some awards attention as well, because it's beautifully written, beautifully filmed, and completely global as well. I mean, the amount of different languages that are spoken in this, which is another thing for this character that Eva Green is playing. She just slips between Russian, German, French, English, and it's like, Matt Dillon, your character, what language can you speak? One. So sit down. It's a really global and I would say universal film.
I did worry at first it was going to go a bit G.I. Jane. It sort of felt like it was heading down that route, but it's a lot more subtle than that. I mean, that was kind of a lot more in your face, much more a kind of a melodrama. But this, I think, it's a bit more nuanced, and you kind of learn a bit more about the characters. I was pleased it didn't go down that route. It was a lot more subtle.
Yeah, I mean, the whole sort of sexual politics and gender politics is only an element of it, really. Yeah. I'd say it's about understanding when you've done enough for yourself, when you're happy with yourself and you're satisfied, you've done a good job. And that's a very difficult thing for anybody to do, to feel that they've satisfied themselves, that they've done the best they can. And whether that's being a mother, a father, an astronaut, whatever it is, you know, journalist, whatever it is that you do as a job, you always wonder, have you satisfied yourself that you've done the best job you can? So are we recommending this one for cinema? I mean, I think it would look great on a massive screen.
Yeah.
Yeah, very much so.
Okay, so we are highly recommending Proxima, which is out again today, Friday the 31st of July. Woohoo! We've also got another film out today, and it's also a cracker.
Come on.
It's time to pack your bags, boys, because we're off to the caravan park.
I've seen someone in one of the vans.
There's no one in those vans.
There is. There's this girl.
She's got a bit of a reputation, you know.
Reputation for what?
Don't walk away from
me. I'm not walking away from you.
Sure about that?
Why are you looking at me? What's wrong with you?
Okay, so that is makeup. Matthew Leyland.
Hi.
Is it about makeup?
It's not really an insight into the cosmetics industry, so I want to disabuse you of that notion straight away, if that's what you're expecting. Like Summerland, this is another writer-director debut. This is Claire Oakley. It's set on the Cornish coast, and it centres on Ruth, who's a young woman who goes to a caravan park to stay with her boyfriend. And everything seems fine at first. But then she begins to suspect that he might be having an affair because she starts finding these suspicious long red hairs around the place. So she kind of goes investigating and she meets up with various people living in the park, some of whom seem a bit sinister. But she forms a kind of friendship with Jade and that kind of progresses in perhaps unexpected ways. It's kind of quite a nice companion piece to last year's Bait, which was another Cornish drama, which had very kind of sinister overtones. And this does as well. I wouldn't say it's quite a horror movie, but it does kind of verge on that from time to time. For me, the main joy of it was how unpredictable it is. Really, you just don't know what's going to happen in the next scene, how kind of expressionist it's going to get, you know, whether something terrible is going to happen or whether something quite joyful is going to happen. And at the centre of it all, you've got Molly Windsor as Ruth, who gives a very strong performance. She's very understated and you keep to her perspective the whole way through. You're following her through this kind of this strange odyssey. And it's very original and very enjoyable as well. How did you guys find it?
I thought it had a really, really interesting tone and really was kind of captivated in the first kind of half or two thirds. You've got this young girl who goes to this sort of near empty campsite and there's just this really weird vibe. And like you say, you don't know what's around the corner. It does have a weird horror-y feel to it. There's weird characters there. The weird lady who sort of runs the holiday park. It's like,
I loved her. I thought she was brilliant.
She's a very mysterious figure. I didn't feel fully didn't fully satisfy me in the where it ended up going. I much preferred the first sort of two thirds.
I agree. I think maybe the journey was more satisfying than the destination. It really built this sort of feeling, this fever dream, really, really well. And then the ending was almost a come down, very much sort of the turn of the screw style. But I really thought it did really well in showing that sort of heightened feeling that you have when you're a teenager and you're having your first romance with somebody and you don't know how you feel about sexuality and your relationship with that person and you're trying to find your way through it. So from that respect, I thought it was a really good sort of impression of what it's like to be a teenage girl.
As a debut, I thought it was very promising and it kind of reminded me of early works of people like Steve McQueen and Lynn Ramsey and Andrea Arnold, that kind of sort of mix of British realism but an expressionism at the same time. Like, I really like the way she used red, like she had those red gas canisters and other red objects kind of dotted around that seemed like these kind of warning flags, and that kite flapping in the background all the time. I really like those tiny details. The amusement arcade as well, that really brought back like trips to the seaside for me. With that kind of edge to it as well.
I mean, even though it was like a sinister seaside scenario, that caravan park looked lovely. I even had a look at it. It's like, it's St. Ives Bay Holiday Park, if anyone's interested. And it looked beautiful.
Open straight out onto the dunes.
Yeah, maybe not during the winter, but it did look lovely. And it did make me think, British holidays. And, you know, we're all going to be doing that, aren't we, in the next couple of weeks? So
yeah,
it's a good one. It's very evocative, very British. Okay, so that is Makeup, which is also out today. So that's four cracking films you can go and see in the cinema. But Makeup, if you don't want to see that at the cinema, you can also see that on Curzon Home Cinema, which is available. So that's good. All right, so what are we going to do next, Matthew? What have you got prepared for us?
Well, it's time for a quiz featuring Russell Crowe, who is out in Unhinged this week. So, are you ready?
We are ready.
Ready.
Go on.
Right, who wants to go first? Who wants to be my first victim?
I don't mind going first.
None shall pass unless they can answer the riddle.
All right, Matt, question one. In what year was Crowe born? Was it A, 1964, B, 1966, or C, 1968? I'll give you a clue. It was in the 60s.
I'm not 100% sure, but I'm going to guess 1964 just because I know Gladiator was in 2000 and he kind of been that young when he made Gladiator. So that's my answer.
You're right.
Hooray! Well
done. Yes, that's one to Matt. All right, Jane, how many times has Crowe been Oscar nominated? Is it A, 2 times, B, 3 times, or C, 4 times?
Well, he was nominated for... Was he nominated for LA Confidential? Probably not. He's nominated for Gladiator. He's nominated for A Beautiful Mind. I feel like there's another one. Oh, The Insider, when he was with the Wiggy and Beefy. Okay, I'm going to say 3.
You're correct. Yeah.
Hooray! So, yeah.
Gladiator, Beautiful Mind, and Insider. All right, Matt, what's the name of his character in 1995's Virtuosity? Is it A, Max 3.0, B, Rick 5.4, or C, Sid 6.7?
What a film.
Yeah, it's been so long since I've seen it that this is just an utter guess. But Max 3.0 just sounds like the most likely, so I'm going to go for Max 3.0.
It's not right, I'm afraid. It's Sid.
Is it Sid? I was torn between that. I just knew it couldn't be Rick 5.4. Okay.
Right, Jane, number 4. Which of the following actors does not appear in Crowe's 2014 directorial debut, The Water Diviner? Is it A, Isabel Lucas, B, Joel Edgerton, or C, Jai Courtney?
It feels like Joel Edgerton would be in that. Who's not in it?
Who's not, yes. So 2 of them are, 1 of them isn't.
I think she is. So I'm going to say that Jai Courtney's not in it.
Wrong answer, I'm afraid. It's Joel Edgerton. Right, Matt, number 5. Worldwide, what is Crowe's highest grossing movie? Is it A, Gladiator, B, Man of Steel, or C, Les Miserables?
This is tough because I imagine they all did pretty well at the box office. But I'm going to go for Man of Steel.
That's the right answer.
Yes,
Man of Steel is his highest grossing movie with $668 million. Well done. Point to you. Okay, Jane, number 6. In which film does Crowe play a character called Terry Thorne? Is it A, Proof of Life, B, A Good Year, or C, The Next 3 Days?
I know this because I remember being very interested in Proof of Life because, if you remember, there was a lot of tabloidy stuff going on around it. So it was Terry Thorne, glamorous name for Russell.
You're completely correct. And I always called him Terry Thomas in that. I could never get my head around that he was called Terry Thorne. Okay, so Matt, you're up. Number 7. Crowe has co-starred in 3 films with Jennifer Connelly, A Beautiful Mind, Noah, and... Is it A, Broken City, B, Fathers and Daughters, or C, A New York Winter's Tale?
God, this is just going to be guesswork again.
Okay.
The only one of those I've actually seen is Broken City. I can't remember if Jennifer Donnelly's in it. I'm going to say A New York Winter's Tale.
Oh, you're correct.
She's, yeah.
Oh, that was... Yes. That was just a guess.
Was that a wild guess?
That was, yeah.
But to be frank, very few people have seen that film.
Yes.
Is that the one with Colin Farrell?
Yes, and horses.
Yeah.
And,
I just didn't realise Russell Crowe was in it.
Yeah, it's an odd one.
Yeah, bit of an outlier. Okay, Jane.
Yes.
Number 8. In which of these Aussie soaps has Crowe not appeared? A, Home and Away. B, The Young Doctors. Or C, Neighbours.
I know he was in Neighbours. I mean, I think that's, part of being an Australian actor. You have to be in Neighbours.
Yeah, obligatory.
I don't know which other one he was in and which one he wasn't. I'm going to take a guess and say, I think, is he a bit older to be in Home and Away? Because that started after Neighbours. But Young Doctors has been going a bit longer. I'm going to say that he was in Young Doctors and Neighbours, but he wasn't in Home and Away.
You're correct.
He's
not.
Yeah. This is as a trivia question, has anyone ever been in Home and Away and Neighbours, or is it one of those things that you contractually you can't be in both?
I think Guy Pearce was in both.
Was he? Oh,
he crossed the streams.
Yeah. All right, Matt, it's your turn. Crowe's 1999 film, Mystery Alaska, centres on which sport? Is it A, curling, B, snowboarding, or C, ice hockey?
I haven't seen this film either. I would love it, I would love it to be curling, but I'm just going to, perhaps incorrectly, take a sensible guess for ice hockey.
Yes.
Ah, yes.
Your word. You're correct. Okay, Jane. So it's, at the moment, it's 4-3. So, Jane,
you need to get this right.
Equal Matt.
Okay.
Okay. So here we go. Of the 5 films Crowe has made with Ridley Scott, which has the longest running time? Is it A, Gladiator, B, American Gangster, or C, Robin Hood?
It feels like it would be Robin Hood because that felt like it went on forever. I know Gladiator was, that must have been nearly 3 hours because I can remember needing the loo right at the start and being absolutely desperate to go but not going because I couldn't tear my eyes off the screen. So that was a long one. American Gangster's pretty long as well, isn't it? Isn't that nearly 3 hours too? Ridley likes a long film, doesn't he?
Yeah.
I think probably Gladiator.
No, sorry. American Gangster.
How many minutes?
American Gangster is 157 minutes. Gladiator is 155. Robin Hood is 140. So
close by 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. So did I lose?
Well, you came second. Say that.
Yeah.
This is my first quiz I've won.
Well done.
Jane got 3. So
yeah, I'm not bitter.
Well.
But that wasn't a shameful loss. I've lost much more shamefully on previous episodes.
Yeah, only by 1 point. Yeah, well done both.
For England, for home, and for the prize!
All right, so that's the end of the quiz. Thank you, Matthew Leyland, for your lovely quiz. And it's time to answer reader's question for this week. You ready?
Okay.
Go for it.
What movie do you never want to see again?
Well, this is a tough question. Like, the first thing that springs to mind, and this is a very douchey answer, but is there's a film I've seen recently that's embargoed, so I can't say what it is, but one film I watched recently. Maybe if you listen to a future episode, I'll say what it was when we review it.
I'm going to WhatsApp you after. I want to know what that is.
But it's a very tough one because, generally it would be if a film was just really grim for me, and I suppose answering this is like thinking of the best film that I would possibly never watch again would be Grave of the Fireflies, the Studio Ghibli film.
I was gonna say that.
Yeah, sorry man.
Why?
It's just such a great film, but it's just so harrowing and so upsetting. Like, I don't think I've probably ever been so kind of upset by a film where like I shed a tear pretty easily at films, to be honest, but then credits come, and you're fine, you're just fine. But this, I was just distraught for like hours afterwards. It's one of those films, I'd love to revisit it one day, but I don't know if I ever can really, so. And then also as well, it's a tricky one for me because there's so many films out there to see, like new films and just, when you're kind of filling in back catalogues that you haven't seen, and all that kind of thing, that I don't re-watch loads of films really these days, so it's only really like the my real favourites that I repeat view these days.
What about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I'd go with Grave as well. I wouldn't want to watch it again just because I wouldn't want to not feel the same way about it. I wouldn't want to watch it and think, you know, meh, or what was I thinking? And the other one I go for is Greasy Strangler, which again I enjoyed in a very different way, but it is kind of relentless and grueling and really horrid, but also kind of brilliant. But yeah, I don't think I could sit through that again. Once was quite enough.
Jay, how about you? What's the film you'd never watch to see again?
I mean, on a grueling one, probably A Painted Bird, which is 3 hours of atrocities. And is so hard to watch. Relentless.
That's not in the UK yet, has it?
It hasn't come out yet. Yeah, and the thing is, it's a really kind of wonderful film. And, you know, loads of famous people in it, beautifully, beautifully directed, and the cinematography is gorgeous. But you have to watch, you know, bestiality, murder, rape, ferrets set on fire. It's relentless and awful, so there's that one. But also, as you would know, having sat with me in the office, the film that I really, really disliked and everybody else loves is The Master. I can't understand why people love this film. And by the time he was singing The Slow Boat to China, I was ready to kill. I never want to see that film again. Sorry, Jamie Graham. I know you love it, but no.
I like the works
of
PTA.
I love two-thirds of it.
Yeah, I'm similar. I really like the first half.
First hour and a half.
I'm not a fan of the second half. And I did actually go back to that because I was like, right, I've got to go back and see if I missed something, you know, the first time. But I felt even more strongly the way I felt the first time.
Oh, really?
About the
ending. Yeah, I've only seen it once. Yeah, I think half of it's great, but I agree it does go on a bit in the latter half.
Never want to see A Slow Boat to China ever again. Okay, so on that note, we'll need to sign off now. It's time to say goodbye. But as always, there is 10% off total film subscriptions if you use the code INSIDETF when you go to checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. So buy someone a subscription. It's a lovely gift. What's on the cover of the current issue, which is out in shops now? And you can go to the shops and the cinema and you can read about Bill and Ted Face the Music. That's our cover this issue. Find out whether they're going to be, you know, going back in time, whether they're going to bring Socrates back or any of those friends. I think it's going to be a good one. Are you excited about it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I love the Bill and Ted films. And this is so long overdue. And it's one of those films you thought would never, ever happen as well. And the fact that it finally has is reason to rejoice.
Yeah.
And just the film we need right now. We need like a fun, buddies, silly comedy.
Keanu, he can do no wrong. Oh, actually, I say again, Keanu, let's talk about the fact that I would never want to see that wedding film he was in with Winona Ryder. Yeah.
Destination Wedding.
I take it back. Keanu can do wrong. And that's one of them. Destination Wedding. Okay, so on that note, we will hopefully be reviewing Bill and Ted Face the Music on a future podcast. But until then, shall we say goodbye?
Goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye. Bye.